The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The prevailing portrait of Muslims in the United States is superficial. They're Arab, African, South Asian, religious zealots who oppress women. At best, they are at odds with American values. At worst, they are threats. There are a few mainstream figures to counter that narrow view: Muhammad Ali, Dave Chappelle, and Mahershala Ali, the first Muslim actor to win an Oscar for his role in this year's Best Picture, Moonlight.
What I've learned from working on Moonlight is we see what happens when you persecute people. They fold into themselves.
Relatively few people saw Moonlight, but in one highly influential and profitable realm, Muslim identity has become a profound influence: hip-hop.
My restlessness is my nemesis. It's hard to really chill and sit still. Committed to page, I'll write around.
Sawad Abdul-Khabir is an anthropologist, artist, and author who writes about the Muslim influence on the genre in her new book, Muslim Cool. Sawad, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
How do you define Muslim cool?
Yeah. So Muslim cool is a term that I'm using to describe a way of being Muslim in the United States that engages blackness to counter anti-blackness. And what I mean by that is that you have young Muslims of a variety of racial and ethnic backgrounds, male, female, different class, you know, sort of statuses, who are listening to and engaging hip-hop music as a way to interpret their reality, and as a way to interpret their reality as Muslims in this country, and as a way to do something about it. And this is the idea of countering anti-blackness, right? That they're going to see both in the wider U.S. society, but also in U.S. Muslim communities.
So this is the American Muslim experience, and you did ethnographic research on young, multi-ethnic American Muslim communities, explored how they express blackness, as you just said. The term you use is perform blackness. What does that mean?
So one of the things that we talk about when we think about just identity in general, like who we are, how we understand ourselves to be, and we talk about that in terms of, also in terms of race, we think about that in terms of performance, right? So there are things that we do that mark us in certain kinds of ways, right? So we don't know that someone is X particular kind of person or group just because of how they look, but also because of the kinds of things that they do. And so this is the idea of the performance aspect of it. It can mean, sometimes people think performance means something that is artificial, you know, like an actor in a play, right? They're not really playing themselves, they're playing somebody else. But one of the things that scholars have shown, right, when we look at sort of just human behavior, I guess more broadly, is that actually the performance is part of how we become who we are, right? So we do these sorts of things to sort of really sort of represent who we want to be to other people, who we are in the world. And so performing blackness here is similar to that, in the sense that blackness is not just sort of what black people do in a kind of really, a really kind of basic sense, but it's also principles and values, sort of dispositions, this way of sort of acting in the world that does come from black experiences but can be accessible to other groups of people. And so they kind of engage blackness as a way of sort of being who they are.
Tell us more about that idea of sort of engaging or performing blackness. How would that show itself?
Performance here is really more of an engagement, is what I'm talking about. And so, for example, one of the people that I talk about in the book is a young Arab American man. He goes by the name, it's a pseudonym, Omar Mukhtar. And one of the things he talks about is that when he began to sort of read, began to listen to hip-hop music, and because of hip-hop music, began to be exposed to sort of authors like Mumia Abu-Jamal, Eldridge Cleaver, and other people from sort of the black radical tradition, the black power movement, and he began to sort of listen to that, read those things, listen to hip-hop music. It really opened up a way for him to understand his own position, not as a black person because he's not black, but as a racial minority, right, as an Arab-American, as a young Arab-American man who actually lived in the suburbs of Chicago, but recognized that, you know, he was also sort of subjected to different forms of discrimination. And the forms of discrimination he was subjected to as a young Arab American Muslim male were related, right, to the ways in which black people of all sort of religious backgrounds have been discriminated against in this country. And so it really opened up a way for him to understand and then to think about what does it mean to live in the world. One of the things I talk about in the book is this concept I call knowledge of self. And knowledge of self is a concept that comes out of the hip-hop community that the hip-hop community has taken from sort of black Muslim communities. And knowledge of self is basically the idea of knowing your past, sort of where you come from, which for many of us is obscured. You don't learn about it in school, right? So you kind of uncover your history so you can interpret your present reality, and then you can do something. You can be active. You can make change. It makes make your reality better and those around you. So, yeah, some of it is stylistic. You know, it is sometimes it's like what you wear, you know, how you hold yourself, but it doesn't stop there. When it stops there, it is a mimicry, right? It's kind of really shallow. But when it really is engaging these values around knowledge of self and around social justice, it's much more.
Hmm. So this image of Muslim cool is a disconnect from the prevailing image that we talked about, admittedly very shallow, especially in the current political climate. There's this idea of Muslims as either they're radicals bent on destroying America from without or, you know, simmering and waiting to strike from within, or the other image, which is, you know, the teeming masses fleeing wars in the Middle East and North Africa on rafts, waiting to be welcomed by the West. Does the idea of Muslim cool counter those larger images?
I would say yes, it does. I think it counters them because it troubles the ways in which we think about Muslims. So both of those kind of images you talked about, either as the Muslim as a victim or as a threat, you know, does position the Muslim as an other, right, as other than American, as something foreign, and therefore potentially threatening, right, or potentially need help. And Muslim cool really is talking about the ways in which the Muslim is a part of sort of what we call the United States, in terms of the ways in which hip-hop, which I think is a kind of a musical genre, a form of culture, that no one denies its relationship to the U.S., right? No one denies its kind of Americanness, right? And yet, if we're going to talk about hip-hop and we're going to talk about it in that framework, then we're going to have to recognize that Muslims have made a significant impact on hip-hop. You know, when I talked about knowledge of self earlier, in the hip-hop community, people talk about hip-hop in terms of elements. So you have DJing, emceeing, and what people call rap, dance, and graffiti art. Four elements, the artistic elements. And the fifth element of hip-hop is knowledge, a knowledge of self. And that's how fundamental the Muslim influence of hip-hop has been. You know, when you read about or you talk to kind of hip-hop pioneers, they talk about listening to Malcolm X, for example. They talk about listening to the Nation of Islam. They talk about listening to other movements related, like the 5% Nation of Gods and Earth, who really encouraged them to sort of think about, have pride in who they were, as black people, as people of color, and to really want to be engaged in sort of changing the conditions of their communities. And so if hip-hop is, you know, sort of super American, you know, undeniably, and Muslims have this impact, then that troubles this idea that they're so other. I think also what it does is, which I think is important to me, Muslim cool is not just saying that, okay, so Muslims aren't other, they're just another, you know, kind of ethnic group in the U.S., because, again, of this emphasis on knowledge of self and on being in social change and social justice, this is what, and we want to talk about who Muslims are in the context of the U.S. and what their impact has been and how they shape the country. It's around those principles of social justice and resistance. And I think that is kind of what Muslim cool counters those images by both countering the otherness of Muslims, but also identifying the ways in which Muslims, the presence of Muslims in this country since the enslaved Africans that came as Muslims, has been to hold it to task.
Hmm. My guest is Dr. Sawad Abdul-Khabir, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Purdue and author of Muslim Cool, Race, Religion, and Hip-Hop in the United States. So here's a clip of Nas. He is a kind of an elder statesman of hip-hop, talking here about perhaps the best-known American Muslim ever, and that is Malcolm X.
What did Malcolm think? Split second before he was shot. Did he think to hit the deck on the floor before he dropped, or did he just say, I'ma die for my brothers, because by killing him, just made his words teach others like Martin Luther King.
So you're connecting that to the black Muslim experience here in the U.S. as the other. As a kind of anti-assimilation, is that the right way to say it?
Well, I mean, I think so. When you talk about, you talked about the South Bronx, you talked about the kind of conditions, right, and this sort of, you know, the ways in which you had communities of color, particularly communities that, you know, sort of we sort of speak of in terms of the African diaspora, whether they're from the U.S. South or from the Spanish or English-speaking Caribbean, you know, coming together in this in the South Bronx and living in these socioeconomic conditions that are trying, but yet being able to sort of produce something out of that, some vitality, which of course is also the marker of the African diaspora in and of itself in many ways. But in that time and in all those kind of cultural and social political conditions is also what I call Black Islam. And so, you know, you have that quote, you know, sort of that Nas clip talking about Malcolm X. And so one of the things we know is that the hip-hop generation in many ways are the beneficiaries of both the civil rights era but also the Black Power movement, right? And the Black Power movement and the Black Power generation were known, like Malcolm X is sort of kind of the iconic symbol of that in terms of his self-determination, having a sense of pride in who you are as a Black person, loving yourself, loving your community, and being committed to that. And really, you know, calling sort of the status quo, right, calling it out for the ways in which it fails to live up to what it says it's supposed to be about. And so that's also a part of that kind of cultural milieu in which hip-hop emerges. And so I think hip-hop has always had a sort of politics to it as well, a politics of, you know, sort of taking the status quo to task, resisting these kind of things, you know, sort of being critical, having a social critique. And much of that social critique, I'm saying, is sort of informed by the ways in which Black Muslims sort of embody that.
Well, hip-hop began with a lot of taunts, a lot of bravado, but evolved into topics considered profane by the FCC anyway, you know. This is stuff haram or forbidden by Islam. So mm-hmm. So how is this reviewed, this kind of crossed fertilization of Muslim cool and hip-hop viewed by the religious community, for example?
Yeah. So one, I would say one, I think hip-hop has always had lots of different stories that people were telling ever since its beginnings. And so you had what people call sort of quote-unquote conscious hip-hop, you know, as well as stuff that may be more commercially profitable, always. And of course, when we see now, you know, there's a way in which we only get part of that story now in the sort of mainstream kind of media use of hip-hop. And I think for some religious communities, Muslims and even other ones, because all they get access to is that kind of really narrow notion of what hip-hop music is, where there's this emphasis on sort of criminality and sort of hypersexuality, all that kind of stuff, you would think, well, that's all hip-hop is. And so how could it have any sort of religious significance of any sort? You know, or how could it be of use in any way to people who want to be sort of pious, you know, as kind of like religious people. But hip-hop is more than that. It always has been. Hip-hop is contradictory because popular culture is, and so you're going to have things that people can interpret it lots of different ways. It can go lots of different directions, you know. But I think that, you know, this kind of core element of knowledge of self we see all the time, and even peeking through things that may seem somewhat irreverent. You know, I think the Grammys is not exactly a religious, you know, space,
right,
you know,
right,
in terms of what people think about it. But, you know, you have this really powerful performance by A Tribe Called Quest, a legendary sort of hip-hop group, whose members, two of whom, Q-Tip and Ali Shaheed Muhammad, are sort of practicing Muslims. They were accompanied by Busta Rhymes and Consequence, who are also hip-hop artists, Black Muslim men as well. And they came on stage that night and they performed some songs from their newest album. And these songs were these kind of, again, this politically charged, you know, social critique. And one of the things that they did also in their performance is they brought on stage a Black Muslim woman. And she was a woman who you knew she was Muslim because of the way her headscarf was styled. And she was there, I think, symbolically as a way of also sort of speaking to that connection, right? Because they're Muslim and what they're rhyming about is not quote-unquote religious explicitly.
Brothers in my hood living in a fishbowl. Gentrify here so it's not no home. Trendsetter, ayo, I know what's called. Top five, y'all, if I could be so bold, but ayo.
For the people that I work with, like I mentioned, that guy on Mukhtar, you know, he's like, it's about the principles. He talks about how hip-hop helped him understand the Prophet Muhammad differently. He said, you know, that Prophet Muhammad is not just about how long his beard was or what kind of clothes he wore, but about these principles, values of freedom and justice and equality. And he's like, you know, this is something that he learned from the RZA, who is a part of the 5% Nation mm-hmm. of Gods and Earths, who is a member of the Wu-Tang Clan, and sort of learning that from the RZA helped him understand the Prophet Muhammad, which helped him understand himself as a Muslim.
Suad, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Sawad Abdul-Khabir, she is author of Muslim Cool, Race, Religion, and Hip-Hop in the United States. You can learn a lot more about her and her work at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Attempt the tale of Sweeney Todd.
Attempt the tale of Sweeney Todd.
He served a dark and a hungry god.
He served a dark and a hungry god.
That's from the soundtrack of the 1979 Broadway show Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. Essentially a staged slasher film about cannibalism that is considered Stephen Sondheim's mid-career masterpiece.
The Demon Barber of Fleet Street.
The play is set in Victorian London, a city obsessed with class and stained by industrial-era smog. It is a classic revenge tragedy. An innocent man is condemned by a rapacious judge. His wife, child, and fortunes lost. He returns to the scene vowing to get even, disguised as the barber, Sweeney Todd. He finds an accomplice to dispose of his victims, the baker, Mrs. Lovett. The gruesome story was urban legend in London, and through Sondheim's genius, a hit musical, though a challenging and musically complex play to stage, even for professional companies with big budgets. So it's a really ambitious choice for Main Street Arts. That's a nonprofit based in Saxton's River, Vermont. But this Sweeney Todd is part of a larger strategy to build community and coordination between a number of small arts organizations on either side of the Connecticut River, a collaboration that defies the sinister nature of the plot. I arrived at the Bellows Falls Opera House in Rockingham, Vermont for first dress rehearsal on a bitter cold Saturday afternoon.
Sorry, and one.
It took some doing to pull this off at the Opera House, which is now a first-run movie theater and hasn't been used for staged plays in 20 years. Sweeney Todd's director and Main Street Arts artistic director David Stern had to petition the select board to hold the play at the theater after the town manager turned the initial request down. Then they all got to know each other and worked things out, allowing the collaborating companies to build the scenery and rehearse during the day when no films were running. A challenge for the almost all-volunteer crew, who all have day jobs.
Stage management, did you get that note?
No.
Okay, Heidi, give them that note as soon as this is done.
Got it.
Okay, ready.
Today, everybody has to be out by 2. And inside the theater, costume makers are crouched on the floor, cast members are standing at attention on and off stage, and they're all focused on one critical part of the production that was not hitting its marks, the set.
They have a whole section, and then it spins.
That's director David Stern discussing the revolving set, which condenses most of the play's locations into a kind of Jules Verne's meets Dickens conglomerate. On one side, there's the grand facade of Judge Turpin's home. On the other, the attic where Sweeney Todd slits the throats of his clients. Below that, Mrs. Lovett's dingy pie shop, where pastries made of the victims are baked and sold. A curvy, steampunky-looking slide shoots out of the side, dispatching those unfortunate souls from barber chair to kitchen. Yes, it's a gory story, but so is Hamlet.
This is probably the most elaborate production I've been involved with here, and it has the look and feel almost of Broadway.
That is lighting designer Ira Wilner.
Okay, stop. And again.
5 days before the show opens, it's looking pretty complicated. In fact, to a visitor, the whole thing looks really demanding.
We have lights in the revolve, so the set can turn. There are no wires, and we're controlling lights wirelessly. There is a red light that's buried right up there, so it shines on the barber chair at the moment the throat is slit. Obviously.
If Ira's nervous, he's not showing it, which I'm told is normal, or the chaos is normal, or so says ensemble cast member Marit Bjerkadal, who I whisper with backstage. She's all gussied up, playing a working girl.
this your first dress rehearsal?
Yeah, I guess it is, yeah.
How's it feeling?
Well, I think we're in that stage where we're all just kind of panicking a little bit because it feels like we have an enormous amount of things to do and there's no way it'll possibly be ready in time, but I have to remind myself this is how I always feel at the stage, so.
Marit is among the 33 cast members and 65 crew who've been focused on this play since auditions took place last summer. There's a sense of discovery for me on two levels. This collaborative production of Sweeney Todd, an insane and wonderful piece of musical theater, and meeting the passionate, abiding community that makes community theater, from sound techs to actors to Sandy Klein, who's creative director of the New England Youth Theater. She's made more than 50 costumes for this play over the past 6 months, and that was after getting input from the actors about their characters and backstories.
Every time I learn anything about community theater, it's unbelievable how much dedication and time people put into it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where my first thought this morning at 5 a.m. was, I know, I'll put a pocket in this guy's t-shirt where the blood can pool. I mean, just like that's my first thought before coffee, which is amazing.
I think I just missed some kind of pep talk.
I do too. What's he saying?
Things are moving fast. Everyone has to be out and cleaned up to give the theater time to prepare for the 3 o'clock matinee.
This was a very good, productive rehearsal. I just want to say for anybody, especially people changing scenery, I'm not yelling at you. I'm yelling with you.
I probably should have admitted this already, but I shudder just a little when I hear community theater. I blame Waiting for Guffman or all those comedy skits that turn earnest, devoted amateurs into wannabes with an outsized need for attention. They make for easy marks, but it's not very generous, especially of me, who went to college with some designs of studying theater, but with none of the resolve or the courage to act. The people I meet rehearsing Sweeney Todd at the Bellows Falls Opera House are brave and determined. They have to be.
Clarity. So, made it through Act One. Good. I would like...
Every single person that's here, people are volunteering. They're finding ridiculous amounts of time outside of their other job and raising their children and brand new babies and people racing off to this place and the other place. And we have attendance issues. Not that people aren't showing up when they said they would, but people aren't showing up because they can't. And that kind of sacrifice and addition to people's lives to the purpose of making something beautiful together, it's moving.
So what stirs people to put aside their lives and make the time? Michael Duffin is co-chair of the board for Main Street Arts. Today he's sporting a mustache that looks like it's been twirled many times. He plays the snake oil salesman Pirelli, who tries to blackmail Sweeney Todd. For him, this communal effort is a counterweight to the cutthroat nature of the real world.
It's crazy. Why do this? Why spend this amount of life energy to have this many mistakes and this many challenges and this many things? Because it pays off. You know, usually we're walking around in our daily lives, in our jobs, in our families, and we have to play some kind of a mask. Well, here it's ironic, a paradox, because when we come on stage, we're not allowed to have masks. We have to be our whole selves.
Which is very funny because right now you have rouge on, really dark eyebrows, and some kind of things going on in your cheeks.
Indeed. You know, so a mask that reveals what is real, it's what feeds us. You know, it feeds us as people.
What feeds us? It's a funny choice of words from a character that ends up baked into a meat pie.
That's to us.
Just a little after two, everything's looking pretty cleaned up, and the movie screen begins to descend over the set. The players have wiped the London soot off their faces, put on their puffy jackets. They're checking their phones, and they look like regular people. The Fleet Street set is still, and outside the great world spins, and Bellows Falls Opera House is ready for the 3 o'clock movie. Some lighter fare, 50 shades darker. Main Street Art's production of Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street, starts tonight and runs for 2 weekends at the Bellows Falls Opera House in Rockingham, Vermont. For more information, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
This is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop with Lindy West.
And I'm Virginia Prescott. Lindy West is a columnist for The Guardian and author of How to Be a Person and Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. She writes about feminism and social justice and body image and pop culture, and lately, a whole lot of politics. Lindy West is a funny and original thinker, and she's brave. She's been a contributor on several memorable episodes of This American Life, one about coming out as fat, and in another, she talked about confronting an internet troll, one of hundreds who had harassed her online. She's got a bunch of balls in the air now, a book tour, TV and movie projects, an idea for a podcast, but we honed in on the demands of being a columnist, those quick turnarounds and deadlines and always an editor waiting for something fresh and interesting. I asked Lindy West about her habits and routines for getting it done and whether she aims for a certain number of writing hours or maybe words each day.
Ah, I wish. It's a print column in the UK. So my editors are in London. I'm in Seattle, which is 8 hours behind. So my deadline is Tuesday mornings in London, which means Monday at midnight for me. So basically every Monday, I wake up, I pitch first thing in the morning, they write back, tell me what they're most interested in, and then I spend the next 12 hours saying, okay, got to get started on the column.
Oh, okay. I think people will be relieved to hear this.
Then around maybe 10 p.m., finally the despair sets in and I really buckle down. And then I usually finish around 2 or 3 a.m., a couple hours post-deadline, at which point I'm literally lying horizontal on my couch with the laptop sort of next to my head and my arms in a completely inhuman position, nodding in and out of consciousness, and wake up Tuesday morning basically with no recollection of what I wrote, and I hope that it was coherent. And weirdly, it is.
Wow, so you write in a kind of like procrastination blackout?
Yeah, like a fugue state. Yeah.
So which is harder for you? Is it like getting that first sentence or getting to the last sentence?
Yeah, it's just getting started. I have to tell myself that that 12 hours, my brain is doing something. You know, like that 12 hours means something and I'm sort of working internally and figuring out what I want to say, because it does often just tumble out very quickly. And I write in a weird way, like I write chronologically, basically, like I write first sentence to last sentence. I don't map it out. I don't move paragraphs around. I don't do outlines. It's weird. I just start and then I go till it's done.
Do you ever try and change that? You know, do you ever think like, okay, this is how it goes. I'm going to just wait until 10 o'clock at night and in panic start writing.
No, I struggle against it every single time. It's a horrible process. I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it. Like I would, it's the animal. If you're writing a column in a day that's tied to the news, you only have the amount of time that you have. And eventually you have to say, okay, this might not be my ultimate masterpiece, but I have to turn it in and I have to go to sleep.
Well, so, you know, you are writing about the news. You are writing a column. You're writing opinions, analysis, pulling things together, which is very different than writing fiction. How is that different for you?
You know, I've never done it. I have 2 more books in my head that I wanted, 2 more nonfiction books. And then I'm definitely starting to turn my gears a little bit about writing a novel.
Hmm.
But it's very scary. I don't understand how people do it. It seems like some sort of sorcery to me.
I have to agree with you. I mean, it is terrifying to me. I'm looking at some of the poll quotes from a couple of your recent columns. Let's see. White nationalists, alt-right, if you see a Nazi, say Nazi.
Bannon's unveiling as Trump's chief strategist is a layer cake of horrors. So you're writing stuff that's throwing down the glove for some people. And I wonder about your interaction with people who read your writing. What is that interaction like? Do you read their comments anymore?
No, I avoid interaction.
I know that you famously confronted a troll. We heard about that story on This American Life.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I used to be much more accessible. I made myself very accessible. Most people that bother to come leave you an abusive comment on Twitter or on The Guardian's comment section, their mind is not going to be changed by you arguing with them. But that has an impact on people who are silently observing, people who are reading. I used to do this a lot on Twitter. If someone came at me with something really abusive or even just a really horrible, bad idea, you know, a really inept point, I would every once in a while pick one of those people to respond to very publicly. If I can either demolish someone's point or, you know, embarrass them, it becomes clear to other people who might share their bad ideas that there are consequences to this hobby. I'm not just a punching bag. I will sometimes respond and you will not like it and you will be embarrassed because I'm better at this than you.
For young writers who are starting out, what's some advice or maybe mistakes you made that you could help them avoid?
If you can stay a million miles away from every single thing that I said when I described my method, do that. Don't write like me. Don't write at 3 a.m. horizontally while crying. But you know, a thing that I always tell young writers that no one ever told me was that writing jobs exist. You know, people tend to be like, oh, you got an English degree, so you're a barista or whatever. And it's like, you know, first of all, nothing wrong with being a barista, but it is not impossible to be a professional writer. There are a million different ways in which you can be a writer. I mean, I started my first real full-time writing job was at a tourist magazine. It's the free magazine that you get in your hotel room. Mm-hmm. It's called Wear Magazine.
Oh, right. I've seen it. Yes, in a million different hotels.
Exactly. And I was the editor of the Seattle edition of Wear Magazine, which means that every month I had to write an entire magazine that was essentially the same magazine because it's for tourists. So you have to cover all the same material every month. So it's like, oh, the Space Needle is cool this month again. Have you heard of the Space Needle? And I would have to reinvent an article about the Space Needle every month, which was actually kind of a productive exercise. Like it really, I think, made me a very fast, very versatile writer. I just feel like there's so much defeatism in this industry where people are like, well, it's impossible to break in. And it's really not. I want people to know that these jobs exist. If you have original ideas, if you know how to construct a sentence, if you turn your work in on time, and if you learn how to pitch.
How about for you? Like, was there a piece of advice about writing that you got that just stuck with you and made a real difference?
I remember when I started working on my book and I was just terrified. I ran into Dan Savage on the street and I was just chatting with him. And he said when he's writing a book, he thinks of it as a big chasm that's opened up in front of him. And he just has to fill the chasm with words.
Wow.
So that he can walk across to the other side. So you're just dumping words into the chasm. And eventually you get to, you know, 65,000, 80,000, however long your book's supposed to be. And then you can walk across and then you can, you know, then you can revise and refine it. And that was really, really helpful to visualize it in that way.
How about worst advice? Has anyone ever, you know, told you something that you just thought, oh, no, please don't tell anyone else that?
I mean, this isn't exactly writing advice, but to especially young women working in publishing, don't listen to male editors who tell you that it's just normal for you to get abusive comments and hate mail all the time and there's nothing they can do about it. Push back against that weird assumption that someone made up because there is something they can do about it. It's not a normal part of your job.
So what's on your nightstand now? What are you reading?
I'm trying to educate myself for the resistance. I just ordered Conflict is Not Abuse, which has been getting a lot of buzz. I was just going to reread The Handmaid's Tale.
Everybody seems... is. I guess it's on the number one on the Amazon list now.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
It just seems tremendously relevant. And then, yeah, I ordered a bunch of like, I don't remember the names of them, but like books about the angry white men of America and why they're trying to kill us all.
So how's the Space Needle looking this month, Lindy?
It's got great views. There's a rotating restaurant at the top. God, I'm so rusty. The Space Needle's cool, though. I wholeheartedly recommend the Space Needle.
Lindy West, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lindy West, she's columnist for The Guardian and author of How to Be a Person, The Stranger's Guide to College, Sex, Intoxicants, Tacos, and Life Itself, and Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. They're both now out on paperback. And we have just enough time to end the show with a little bit of radio ephemera. This comes from a series called Random Tape by David Weinberg. He's a guy who for years recorded just about everything that happened in his life and stuck bits and pieces online. This one is called Just Molly and Me.
So Francis Matern was the organist at St. Henry's Catholic Church for over 25 years. And he came over to my house one day because he wanted me to record some of his poetry. And Francis is blind, so he had printed his poems with a Braille machine on old magazines. So he sat down in my living room, and I recorded some of his poetry, and he told me some stories. And this is an excerpt from that session. It's called Just Molly and Me.
The next group of poems is about my relationship with God. You know, in Genesis, says Jacob wrestled with an angel. Well, Jacob might have wrestled with an angel, but God and I have downright fist fights. And this first poem is called Just Molly and Me. Molly was a sweet lady, and she knocked on my door one winter night when it was drizzling rain and came in, and we struggled with temptation for a long time. I'm not going to tell you how it ended. It's not your business. But anyway, this is called Just Molly and Me. Sitting at the kitchen table, let us send to God a cable. Tell him who the hell he thinks we are. Goldfish in a pickle jar? Are we laboratory fruit flies for him to tease and tantalize? Hey, put your mother on the line. Your eternity is our time. Hail Mary, full of grace, kick the devil in the face. That's the end of that.
Thank you so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, and Ari De Niro. There's always more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.